A lot of people often feel guilty that they have a lot of money. And I think those people, I always say, put your money aside. Let's talk about you and your talent and how you can put it to use.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. We like to speak to a different guest each and every week and hear something of their life story and their faith journey. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week is John Studinski. He commits his time to business, finance, and philanthropy. Since 2018, he served as managing director and vice chairman of PIMCO, which is a global investment management firm. John is the founder and chairman of the Genesis Foundation, a UK-based charity that supports freelance artists. He's commissioner of the United Nations Commission on Modern Slavery and Human Trafficking, and he's also chancellor of Leeds Trinity University. He was awarded a CBE for his services to the arts and charity. Pope John Paul II awarded him a papal knighthood for his work with the homeless. And he has a new book out entitled A Talent for Giving. I'm delighted to say that John joins me now. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you to invite me to speak.
I'd love to know what gets you up out of bed in the morning. What is it that drives you?
Well, I get up every morning at 4 o'clock. Although many of my close friends who get up and pray at 3 o'clock in the morning because they think that's the hour to really pray because it confronts some of the dark forces of the world by having a robust prayer at 3 a.m. I don't do that. I get up at 4 a.m. And what gets me out of bed is, if I'm thinking of it in a whimsical way, I think about the number of other people whom I respect, who I know are getting up at the same time and following a very disciplined routine. I see, because of the way my life works, I see 4 to 8 in the morning, and I go to Mass every day at 8 o'clock. I see 4 to 8 as a period of my private time, my prayer time, my contemplative time. It's time to exercise. It's time to walk in the park with my dogs. It's time to think about the day and the week. So I do think time is the most powerful gift from God. And as you might know, I had a near-death experience in May 1987, in terms of a car crash in Frankfurt, which I survived. And I guess after that, I was even more mindful that I had some purpose in terms of, in a fairly powerful way, and much more rigorous about being even more God-centric.
Yes, and it's so often the case, isn't it, when people have those very dramatic, life-changing, almost near-death experiences, it causes us to kind of rethink everyone. It sounds like that was the case for you. You were only 23 when that car crash happened, is that right?
No, I was born in 1956, so May 1987, I would have been 31.
31. And just tell us a bit about exactly what happened.
Well, I was at Morgan Stanley at the time, working in investment banking. And I flew into Frankfurt, and I was going to a board meeting at a German pharmaceutical chemical company called Herxt. And we were on the Autobahn late in the afternoon in May, and there was a torrential downpour. And one of the cars was probably traveling too quickly ahead of us. And the German word is aquaplana, or English word is hydroplaning, spun around and interacted and crashed with a number of other cars. And my driver, couldn't brake in time, but did brake. Of course, the airbag in the back seat opened. My driver did not survive. I broke all my ribs in 3 places, my left arm in 62 pieces, which was subsequently put together, and I lost a lung. It was one of those powerful experiences. I was in intensive care for a week. The German, he was actually worked for the German Olympic Committee. He was a very powerful orthopedic surgeon. He came in one morning, and I was on a life support system, and he said, I noticed you've got very strong faith. And I said, how do you know that? He said, well, you meditate, and you don't talk about it, but I watch you and you meditate. He took this big leather medicine ball, he threw it at me, and he said, I want you to pray and meditate and inflate this. And if you do, you'll inflate your remaining lung. Otherwise, you'll be on a artificial breathing apparatus the rest of your life. So I was impressed with his astute observation of me, and I sat there and I prayed and meditated for a good hour with my medicine ball, and I inflated my lung. And it was that perfect example, and we've all had it, where you have very emotional prayer that is so focused on real, what I call real prayer, because it's entirely embracing God and asking God for something in a very powerful, emotional, spiritual, and soulful way. And it's not peppered with a lot of flowery language or anything. It's getting down to really emotional, almost physical type prayer. And I was very grateful. And that was almost another, apart from saving my life in terms of my lung, it also gave me another powerful insight into prayer.
Wow. It's an incredible story, incredible moment. And just help fill in the blanks between the car accident and your early life. So I understand you grew up just outside of Boston, had a Catholic family. And in terms of faith, was it fairly straightforward from a child all the way up to that accident in your 30s in terms of believing the faith, being raised in the faith? What's your memories of that time?
Well, yeah, no, we were very, we certainly would practice faith on Sundays and quite often during the week as well. My mother was a very strong Christian and Catholic. She took care of a lot of people as a nurse during the war, World War II. And because I was born on St. Joseph's Day in the Catholic Church, which is March 19th, in the morning, she perceived that to be very auspicious because I was born in a very dramatic blizzard. And she felt, because of her biblical scriptures, she felt that any child that's born in a dramatic way, particularly on a very important saint's day like St. Joseph. I remember even at the age of 5 or 6 coming home from nursery school and saying to my mother, I really would like to have everybody meet you and bring the nursery school to have come home for supper. And she said, that's no problem. And I said, good, because I've invited them all for Monday night and Monday evening. That was the time then we began talking about what we could do to support the homeless and the poor in the town in which I lived, because there was a need at that time for a soup kitchen, and no one organized it. So we got a group of young people, and I mean, you're talking about 5 and 6 year olds, who you would think were clueless, but we were very purpose driven, and we didn't want to waste time. So I was very conscious on, you know, it's very funny because you learn early on that you can't often teach young children about the scriptures or even about faith, but you can teach them through service. And quite often doing service gives people a much closer proximity to humanity and to the will of God. And you know, it's not just the Good Samaritan and the man on the street. People don't realize they get such power and they get such energy, they get such grace through service. And young children, that's why I'm a big fan of volunteerism as being part of a core curriculum in schools, is such a powerful way to teach faith and teach Christianity.
Yeah. So did your mother have a sense that there was something special about you because of the circumstance of your birth? Was you know, founding a soup kitchen at the age of six, was that sort of confirmation of that?
Well, I think she felt that I was always going to be very outgoing, and I was brought up in a family driven by my grandparents, where everybody was very generous. My grandparents were Polish immigrants, and you know, they we were brought up in a sense of community. My grandparents were very involved in building the church. And so there was always a great sense of some type of role in the church. But I'm always, you know, I'm very mindful of the fact that we've got to separate the word church from religion, from faith, from spirituality, because they all overlap, but they're all slightly different.
Sure. Now, I know you went on to, you've had an incredible career in banking, investments, HSBC, Morgan Stanley, Blackstone. Tell me, you know, for people who aren't familiar with those kind of corporate environments and the world of finance, what's been your experience as a Catholic and as a Christian of working in those worlds? You know, has it been straightforward? Have there been ethical dilemmas? Because some people might assume that working in the corporate space like that would sometimes be a challenge to faith. Is that correct?
You know, it is and it isn't. You have to, first of all, you have to remember when I entered Wall Street in June of 1980, I was told by one of my colleagues at Morgan Stanley that I was one of the first Catholics to join the firm. It was very heavily Anglican or Episcopal, and that's fine. And then, of course, I when I moved to England from Morgan Stanley in 83, 84, I would often find myself sitting at dinner parties where people would say, because, of course, in the 80s in England, the Anglican faith, when George Basil Hume, he developed an extraordinary ethos and brand for Christianity and Catholicism. But I'd be sitting next to people saying, so I understand you're Catholic. And I would always say, absolutely. But then my reaction is always to turn it around and immediately say, well, let's talk for a minute. When's the last time you think you were in the presence of God? And people will say, what? What? And I'd say, well, when do you think you were in the presence of God? And they'd say, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, yes, you do. I said, we're all in the presence of God at certain times, in certain moments, with certain events. So let's unpack what that's happened over the last year in your life. There must be one or two moments where you were in the presence of God. And inevitably, people are afraid, people who don't believe in God, or people who are, say they're agnostic or atheist or whatever words you want to use, they are very curious about talking about God. The other thing I would say, in my business career, people would acknowledge the fact often that I would go to Mass every day, and they would be very respectful of it, but they also felt that, you know, values, Christian values, have a lot to do with community, teamwork, and you treat people the way you want to be treated. And this love thy neighbor as thyself means you have a sense of engagement and community and respect for other people. So I always do that without necessarily being overly dogmatic or overly difficult. But people would inevitably, you know, it's very interesting. in my career, I've had people come visit me who became clients who wanted first to talk about faith and how I'm able to have this whole, the English are preoccupied with God and mammon. How can someone be interested in God and money? And I just go to the scriptures and say, you know, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and give to God what's God's. You've heard that hundreds of times. But I think also when people talk about, why do you work with all this money? And I say, well, the more money I make, the more I can give away, number one. And I think we're all given the ability to allocate assets. You know, your greatest asset is time, but your other great asset is not money. It's talent. And that's, of course, one of the topics our book is about. But so I actually think we're all asset allocators in our lives. And whether you have money, time, talent, ties, other types of attributes, you know, God wishes you to allocate those things in a way. So I don't regard money. I spent a lot of time in my late teens working with Mother Teresa in India, in Calcutta, in the leper colony. And she always nurtured me and said, remember, you can only change the world one person at a time. And she was quite rigorous at taking money from anyone, and I mean anyone. And she would always say, the money comes to me, I bless it, and I put it to good use.
Yeah, it's about what you do with it, isn't it? I guess the question is more not how much you have, but how you're using it.
And I think what's interesting about giving and philanthropy is people can actually, people unfortunately, so much of what I've written is targeted really at Generation Z or Z, 15 to 30 year olds. People think that to be, have an impact in society, you need to have a lot of money. I actually don't think that's right at all. You have to understand your entrepreneurial skills or your talents. And you probably know I talk about the parable of the talents in the book, particularly the gentleman who buries his talent, because I think we all bury certain talents that have to be unearthed and nurtured and put to good use. But I also think we can do a lot with them if we actually juxtapose our talents with what we're passionate about or what we're angry about. And actually, young people are very interesting today. When you ask them what they're passionate about, often their eyes glaze over and say, well, I'm not really passionate about anything. If you ask them what they're angry about a whole laundry list of things. And those are the types of things you can do a lot work with. And this is, you know, this is nothing very modern. This is, you can find all this in the scriptures, whether it's the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, or the New Testament, in terms of to whom much has been given, much is expected. And those who have been given much, more is even expected. And I think these things are very powerful. And I think a lot of people often feel guilty that they have a lot of money. And I think those people, I always say, put your money aside. Let's talk about you and your talent and how you can put it to use.
The new book is called A Talent for Giving, and it's released in the UK in September. It's about creating a more generous society, isn't it? And you've not written a book only for those with great wealth and great means. You want this to be inspiring for people, I guess, regardless of what their personal wealth is. But can you just speak to that a little bit more? Because I think a lot of people would say, well, the people who can make a difference, they are the millionaires. You know, if I have £100 to give away each month, that's not going to make nearly as much difference as someone who's giving away £1 million a month.
That's certainly the vernacular. I think you said something earlier that relates directly to this, which is, and you often hear a lot about metrics in philanthropy. The truth is, you can only, and I again, going back to Mother Teresa, you can only change the world one person at a time. But you have to remember, if you transform one person's life, and, you know, in my foundation, the Genesis Foundation, if someone receives a grant or receives support or receives mentoring, the contractual arrangement is, apart from what they're supposed to produce, whether it's a piece of sacred music, set design, or some type of exhibition, they also have to, it's incumbent upon them to agree to mentor other people. I do think the power of two, namely mentoring, is very great. So you can have a big impact on individuals, and there's a domino effect. If you, in your own career, you probably look back and say, who gave me my first break? Or who trusted me? Who invested in me? Who nurtured me? Who gave me an apprenticeship? Everyone listening to this should think about who gave you your first break, because that actually enhanced your dignity, your self-confidence, your identity as a human being in the face of God. And I think that is something that is really powerful. And sometimes large checkbook philanthropy doesn't always do that on the first base or the second base. No question financial wealth enhances the state of the planet, but it has to be deployed in a what I call a stealth bomber way, which almost comes through the human channel, through the human condition. And I think there's so much potential in individuals if people take it upon themselves to say, I can do something. What am I good at? What am I interested in? What am I angry about? So I think money is a tool, and it's obviously out of the time, talent, and treasure, it's the treasure. But I almost think treasure without time or talent, it withers on the vine very quickly, and it doesn't necessarily go as far. You know, it's like not watering the mustard seed. It just sits there.
Yes. I was having a conversation with someone in my church just this past week who said that this person's way of giving to the church is they're a professional sound engineer. A lot of churches don't have great sound equipment or don't know how to use equipment they've got. And he says, well, my gift to the church is I give them my time to train people how to use the sound equipment because that's my job, that's what I know. And he said, frankly, you know, my time on that is actually more valuable than whatever I could give in terms of cash because this is an area of expertise. And there's something in that, isn't there, of all of us thinking, well, God has gifted us more than just money and finance, but with our time and our talent, and those things can be incredibly... it can be an incredible gift to the church and to humanity and to the world if we choose to use them in the right ways. And I suppose your book's helping to unlock some of that thinking and see giving as more than just wealth.
There are a lot of case studies of my own personal journey in trying to enhance the common good. I don't talk about other people. I talk about myself. I think I only know about myself. I'm not going to talk about other people. There's lots of books written on philanthropy. The genesis of this book was I had written a piece for the New York Times two or three Christmases ago. And Nigel Newton, who's the founder and editor and the CEO of Bloomsbury, read it. And he did an interesting thing. He circulated it to his editorial team and said, what other books are written taking this entrepreneurial perspective on contributing to the common good? And he called me in middle of February and he said, Studs, we've looked at this. There's nobody who's written a book on this subject. Can we commission you to write a book on entrepreneurial giving? And I said, well, I think you're out of your mind. I've never written a book. He said, well, no, it could have a big impact on a lot of people's lives. So, and you know, this is the same Nigel Newton who embraced people like J.K. Rowling vis-a-vis Harry Potter and a number of other great writers. So he encouraged me because he felt that it was an interesting tangent. And, you know, to a certain extent, if you look at the state of the planet now in the last 2 and 3 years, I think the role of giving and philanthropy and charity on the grassroots level, at the individual level, is potentially going to have more of an impact now than ever before, where people take it upon themselves. They can't rely on government. They can't rely on corporations. They can't rely on foundations. What do they themselves want to do to enhance society for the common good?
This August in Premier Christianity magazine, we dive into justice, music, and football. Lawyer Janice Machemi talks about campaigning for the powerless, worship leader Pat Barrett on Christian music's big comeback, and Premier League legend John Bostock, who leads Ballers in God. Subscribe for 12 months at $44.99 and receive a free copy of Inspired, the best-selling book by Simon Gilbo. Sign up at premierchristianity.com. I'd love to delve into some of the areas of giving that you've been, I suppose, most passionate about. You mentioned one already, which is the Genesis project that you're involved in, which is really centered around the arts and giving grants to perhaps young actors to help them in their career. But you've also been very involved in human rights and in homelessness as well. How do you decide? Do you feel called by God to go into certain areas and to back certain projects? How do you decide where to put your resources?
You know, it's actually, like a lot of things, it's simpler than it would seem. It's not technically, if you look at everything I relate to, I'm fascinated. You know, at the core of the Aramaic faiths, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, at the core of Aramaic faiths is a core set of values which revolve around human dignity and respecting the human person, the human condition, and humanity. And, you know, like those faiths, of course, have 90% of them, 90% of the values are all similar. It's the 10% where there's always the difference, and which causes tensions in terms of interfaith tensions and religious coexistence. But everything I do relates to human dignity, whether it's enhancing someone's life if they're homeless, whether it's trying to rescue someone. I do a lot of work with Talitha Kum, 1.5 million religious sisters in 90 countries, in terms of taking people out of modern slavery, either through rescuing them or training them, educating them to be wary of slavery, or helping them as survivors of people who've been trafficked. That all relates to their humanity and their dignity. If you're a young artist and you're trying, and you're not from the upper middle class in England, and you're trying to get into a network relating to becoming a composer, an actor, a painter, a poet, a photographer, a set designer, whatever, sometimes you do need your first break or two. And as I said earlier, when you give someone a break, you really enhance their self-confidence and their dignity. So everything I do relates to human dignity. Even, you know, I've been a big supporter of Riding for the Disabled in the UK. Over, you know, 250 community riding academies. And you're sitting there going, wait a minute, John, you're not a horsey person. Well, actually, I don't know if you know what the RDA really does. It takes people who are have some disability, and you put a disabled person, physically disabled person, on a horse, which is powerful, has four legs, and they spend a certain number of hours a week on that. That can enhance their motor skills. That can also enhance their mental acuity and give them a greater sense of self-confidence and dignity. So the RDA, while everyone thinks it's about horses and in the glamorous English countryside, actually it's more about working in the community, and the horse is the tool to enhance the dignity of the individual. So I think we have to, you know, it comes down to helping people. It doesn't always have it. You know, there's so many different channels, so many different vehicles that you can actually put your hand up and help people. And sometimes you might want to volunteer first to see what the culture is of an organization. You've got a theory about something, you might want to volunteer at two or three different organizations to test them out before you start your own or start your own project if you think you've got an idea that addresses an issue in a constructive way.
You were six when you were volunteering in that soup kitchen. I imagine volunteering might look a little bit different for you now, does it?
Well, I still do it. I still work on at the Passage on Sunday nights as the receptionist because I think the thing people have to remember about volunteering is we think we're giving our time and our personality and our energy and our insights or whatever. But you know what? Sometimes working with people holds up, you know, God does a good job of holding up a mirror. And I believe strongly that God speaks to us through people, other people, particularly the marginalized and the poor and the vulnerable. So, you know, quite often over time I continue. I think it's always important. You know, you can be very, very practical and volunteer. Then when you become very knowledgeable, perhaps you go on the board. Then sometimes you go back to volunteering. And I remember by having both perspectives, you start to see an organization from two different complementary perspectives. One is the sort of grassroots and one at the board level, which is a necessary governance, but quite frankly, it can be very different.
I love the way that you're still, as you say, involved in the grassroots and the day-to-day. It reminds me of that quote from St. Teresa of Avila, who said, "The devil enters your soul through your ego." And it strikes me that actually being among those less fortunate and helping them practically or sitting on the reception desk or giving a bowl of soup, it's probably quite healthy for keeping you grounded.
Well, you know, it's very interesting you target that quote. That's one of my favorite quotes that I use in business. And if sometimes when I notice people's egos are potentially destroying them or creating an awkward meeting or situation, I will say, remember, the devil enters your soul through your ego, and it will use your ego to manipulate you, potentially to suit the devil's purpose. So I think whenever I sense my ego is getting out of control, I sit there and pause and stop and say, what's going on here? This is not about your ego. This is about a number of other things.
How's your faith changed over time? It strikes me in talking to you, it sounds like it's been a very consistent presence, and even your prayer life sounds very consistent. I imagine there might have also been some ups and downs as well, perhaps some times of doubt. How have you navigated that?
Well, I've never had times of doubt, but it has been up and down. I think it's gone from a very formalistic training as a child, what I call religious formalism, of sort of church and catechism and all of that through the sacraments of communion and confirmation, to now a period where it is very much, you know, Basil Hume always used to say to me, religios means path to God, meaning, you know, the church is the sort of descendancy of the chair of St. Peter. But you do need to maintain a strong prayer life. And I think as I age, and now I'm reaching a phase of my life, I'll be 70 in March. It's, I would say the last phase, entering the last quadrant of my life. I do find myself spending a lot of time with people who are much closer to illness, severe illness, and death. And I spend a lot of time with people as they contemplate. Talking about death and going home to the Lord. So my prayer life has evolved a lot into becoming, in some respects, as your prayer life evolves, it becomes simpler, it becomes potentially more regular, and it also becomes potentially more repetitious, and it even becomes more contemplative. Even sitting and staring at the cross for 10, 20 minutes a day. When someone says to you, well, what are you actually praying when you're staring at the cross? And sometimes the answer is you're not praying anything. You're just being in the presence of the crucifixion, which is the most powerful thing that we all have witnessed.
Yes. I was reading about some of your relationships, friendships with previous popes. And am I right in thinking that you had a conversation with Pope John Paul II when you were even contemplating whether you should perhaps be going into the priesthood? What did he tell you?
Well, he was a great, as you know, he trained to be an actor, and he was going to be an actor. And then one day he had a significant calling in the middle of one of his performances. And he immediately decided he would go into the church. And it was really his acting skills that really it strengthened his ability to be a very powerful spiritual leader. Because he was very charismatic, he was able to travel the world, and I remember also his great moments when I would go to papal masses with him, particularly on World Youth Days around the world, and he would convene all the cardinals, the bishops, the priests, and he would say, okay, there are thousands of people here today, many of these people have walked long distances, for many people this will be the most important day in their lives, for many people this will be a very spiritual moment. So you all must go out there and put on a good show. It's not about you, it's about them. And he was he gave this very powerful pep talk. But when I asked him, I said to him one day, when we were quietly, just two of us were sitting there, we were in Częstochowa in Poland, in the Pauline Monastery. I said to him one day, you know, I go back and forth on whether or not I should think about going into the clergy. And he said, no, 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 no. No, 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 no. He said, you've done a lot already. You'll be much more powerful to God and to the church by not being into the church and part of it. You'll have a lot more flexibility. You'll have a lot more creativity. He said, I it's not only my opinion, he said, but I have a very strong message that you should remain on your current track. And he was very almost powerfully mystical about it. He wasn't saying it just to, and he's right. My ability to implement, to create programs, I've commissioned over 30 pieces of sacred music. I'm proud of all of the commissions. I'm particularly thrilled with I think one of the most interesting pieces of sacred music in the 20th century, the Stabat Mater, I commissioned for James McMillan to do, which is a very powerful Stabat Mater. It will become one of the great classics, like the Pergolesi, because in the last 10 minutes of the music, when Christ is dying, and that drama of, you know, mother behold your son, behold your mother, at the foot of the cross, he captures that brilliantly. And it's a beautiful piece of sacred music.
Amazing. Have there been moments in your life, subsequent perhaps to that conversation with Pope John Paul II, where you have actually felt that sense of calling? Of actually, you know, I'm in the right place. God has got me in these different places for good reason. And you felt kind of confirmed that this has been the right path through your life and it's not been to enter the priesthood.
Well, I think there's a fine line, and I'm sure many people listening today have these moments where they enjoy prayer. They enjoy prayer in a group, which you would have in a religious community. They enjoy routine in terms of the consecration, communion, and prayer. But I also know, and we just had the gospel this past weekend of Martha and Mary, and the juxtaposition of that, and of course the wrong way to read that gospel is to think that through Christ's words, it's all about saying that Mary has it right and Martha has it wrong. No, that gospel is about the fact that there are moments in life to pray and you know, when God shows up, you've got to be front and center with God. But there's also a moment when you are there to serve not God, but the community as a member of the flock, and in terms of supporting the marginalized and the poor and the vulnerable and what have you. So this juxtaposition between contemplation and service, they're both powerful and they're both equally important.
Absolutely. I was reading an interview you gave previously where you made a great suggestion, I thought, that we should forget the Sunday Times rich list and instead publish a list of the money given away as a percentage of wealth and see what that looks like. And you said, I think it would look very different. You said there would be a lot of shame on news out there and people might be a little bit more thoughtful about giving. Is that still your view? You said that a number of years ago now to the Times, but do you think there's scope for that, of actually publishing these are the people who are doing good with their wealth?
Well, I think I would move on a bit and say, I think that would say that's looking at the sole metric of money. And that's looking at the metric, as you and I, and I've cited before, of checkbook philanthropy. Many people have created foundations, many people have set goals and objectives, and have built strategies around a broader set of issues. I think where I've evolved to is that the rich list can still probably do much more to empower talent, to empower people to give time through volunteering and to be there as a resource. And I don't, you know, I've had the challenging conversation across the world of some very wealthy people. And look, many wealthy people give away a lot of their money through foundations. I think I've also reached a point where who am I to judge? I think everybody has to be minded of the fact that we all forget how often we judge. And I'm probably at the top of the list. I should shut my mouth more when it comes to judgments about how people spend their money. But having said that, I would be more inclined to encourage them to look at partnerships with a broader range of society, where you can encourage more people to engage in giving for the common good.
And as you say, you've had the opportunity to have those frank conversations with people where that's been invited and where it's not been from a place of judgment, but it's been an honest discussion. What's your view on the next generation, Gen Z? Will the next generation of entrepreneurs rise to this challenge of being generous? Do you have hope about that?
Well, I'm very blessed. I've been asked, as you might know, by the BBC. I'm a regular contributor now on Thought for the Day. And my last piece I did a few days ago was on Generation Z. And I said, look, I think the media and the world has Generation Z wrong. We talk about them through Jonathan Haidt's book as the anxious generation tied to social media. The data suggests they actually are bottoming out on the use of social media and certain types of apps. The data suggests that the 15 to 30-year-olds have an increased likelihood that they believe in a higher power. Many more are going back to Christian services in North America and the UK. So the data has shifts. And I think while this generation is seen, to use that terrible word, as high-maintenance snowflakes, the reality is they're hypersensitive. And I think we have to be careful. Hypersensitive people means they're closer to humanity, they're closer to the human condition, they have more insights into human dignity, and they're closer to God. And I think for those reasons, I think they represent a substantial generation of hope. I really do.
It's encouraging to hear. You hinted at this earlier. You mentioned you're going to be 70 soon, and reflecting on people who you interact with who are entering, I think you called it, your final quarter of life. Are you finding yourself reflecting more on your own legacy and how you'd like to be remembered?
I've never done that. I don't think about how I want to be remembered. I only want to be remembered by the individual people whose lives I've touched. I don't think you want to be remembered. I'm not big on remembering. It's nice when people, like you started this conversation by referencing the passage. And it's nice to be remembered that I played a role in creating the passage. It's nice to be remembered when people walk in and see my name somewhere at the passage. But I'm not into vanity building sites or bricks and mortar. I think it's more a question of how many lives have you touched and how many people have you inspired to touch the lives of others. You have to go, let's get realistic. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. That isn't, I mean, we all hear about that. We think about it all the time. It's profound on Ash Wednesday. But it is a reality. You know, we're a speck in the universe. And you've just got to remember, it's more about today and your behavior today and how you enhance the human condition.
Absolutely. Now, before we go, I must ask you, I think you mentioned already you've had a relationship with the last four popes, I think. And I know certainly when Pope Francis died, you were on CNN talking about his legacy, talking about your own friendship with him, really. So I'd love to hear a bit more about that, and perhaps also about your hopes for the Catholic Church under Pope Leo, and what direction you think he will bring, and what your impressions are so far.
Well, I think the Holy Spirit has, you know, gets a 10 out of 10 in terms of delivering four great popes in a row, John Paul II, Benedict, Francis, and now Leo. The reason you're going to say that's a strong statement, four great popes, they're great because each one was the relevant best pope for that point in history. You know, John Paul II, rigorous in terms of the Cold War, rigorous in terms of the Berlin Wall, rigorous in terms of behind-the-scenes diplomacy, yet at the same time being a media pope globally. Benedict, a rigorous, one of the great German theologians over the last 150 years. His book on Jesus of Nazareth is a great inspiration. For those of you who have not read it, it's a must read, the Jesus of Nazareth by Pope Benedict. Francis was the first Jesuit. And remember, Jesuits are grassroots, teach people to fish rather than give them a fish. He didn't like business people, didn't like people like me. But on the other hand, asked me to help early on with modern slavery and human trafficking. And as a result, was very, I saw the vulnerable side of him as well as the formidable side. And you've heard me say there was an Old Testament side of him, which was rather authoritative. And there was rather a New Testament side of him, which was rather empathetic, sympathetic, and compassionate. And they coexisted beautifully. Pope Leo, of course, I never thought I would see an American pope in my lifetime, because the American Catholic Church is, many people feel as though in Rome that it's too political or too conservative. Here we are. We've got someone who has the ideal CV, a missionary, a head of a religious order, of all things an Augustinian, and someone who is an American, who has a great sense of American ethos, missionary experience, and he's also spent just 2 years, really, as a cardinal. So he's a new cardinal. He's only been a cardinal since 2023. Head of the dicastery to appoint bishops. And when you appoint bishops, you get a real cross-section of the world as it relates to who the talent are, the priests, and you basically can formulate the future of the church leadership, and that's what he's done. So I think the church is entering a new era. It's an era where English is going to be a much more spoken language, and all the margins of the world who understand English are for the first time. And this really began with the, remember, out of Pope Francis appointed so many people from the peripheries of the world to become cardinals, and they were a big part of the voting. And therefore, you can see why they would have voted comfortably for someone who was both a missionary, but someone who spoke English, and someone who has, quite frankly, a great deal of humility. The other thing I like about him, he's going to make the cardinals work. He's going to put them to work, delegate a lot, and put them on a lot more committees in a very inclusive way.
It's fascinating. Thank you so much, John Studzinski, for joining us here at Premier. It's been wonderful to hear some of your life story and find out more about the book. It is released this September. It's called A Talent for Giving, published by Bloomsbury and available wherever books are sold. John, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain-rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save